Make sure you are in fellowship, rebound if necessary. And as probably everybody knows here, if you haven't met everybody, Tom and Debbie Hardwick are here visiting from Oklahoma City. And we have Chet with us today, and of course Bill and his family are here. So you're shipping out when? 1st of July? Or
1st or middle of July.
For Iraq, so you might want to put him on your prayer list. There's no danger over there. And so if you weren't depressed enough, let's continue with the depression here as Solomon bemoans his sad state of affairs. But he got here, again, recognize all this, that he got here on his own volition. That this wasn't as though God forced him into this and made him do all these things. He did it because he chose to. He was involved, again, as we know, failure under the doctrine of separation, which has killed so many believers who will not separate from that which is evil, from that which is opposed to God's plan. And so it's a tough doctrine, but again, it's also one of those doctrines, I would think one of the four or five, there's a handful of doctrines, not that every doctrine's not important, but there's a handful of doctrines that are going to kill you if you fail in them. Rejection of authority is going to kill you. It'll absolutely kill you if you fail in it. Separation, if you don't separate from that which is evil, eventually it's going to get you. You will be dragged down by that which you associate with. Unforgiveness, that's another key. When you can't forgive, well, then you might as well just not bother rebounding, because God's not going to forgive you. You're going to be out of fellowship all the time if you don't forgive. So those are three key ones right there. Four, I would say, the local church. If you've got to get in a local church, get under a pastor, follow him to maturity and all that. So those are some pretty key doctrines that if they're blown off, ultimately you're going to pay the price. Well, we know Solomon blew off separation when it came to his women. So under the polygamy aspect of it, 700 wives and 300 concubines. We might say slave women. But the idea here is that they dragged him down. He got into idol worship, as we know. And all of this, and then began to try to fill his empty life with all these other things. And guess what? Doesn't work. It doesn't work. There's only one thing that's really going to fill your life, and that is doing God's directive will. That's where true happiness lies. And those that won't do that, they're never going to be happy. And there are what I like to call the professional misery people. They're not happy unless they're miserable. They're going to live miserable all their lives. They're just going to be a miserable wretch until they miserably die and all of that. Well, I don't want to be one of those. If that's all their life has to offer, I would be as depressed as Solomon. But clearly, it's not all life has to offer. There's a lot of great things about life. Do you hear Solomon talking about any of the good things in this? No. He is absolutely a self-centered, self-focused idiot at this point in his life. And he knows it now. I mean, the older Solomon, writing about it, of course, recognizes this. But we should recognize it. The self-centered person, again, there's two types of people in life. There's the givers and there's the takers. The takers are never going to be happy. That's not the essence of the Christian life. The essence of the Christian life is giving. For God so loved the world that he took his only begotten. No, he gave his only begotten son. So, happiness is to be found. It is available. But it's not available to the selfish person. It's not available to the self-centered person. They're never going to be happy, the takers. So here we have Solomon at this point in his life. It's all about him. If you look, I told you before, but for those of you that are visiting, in this chapter 2, half of the times he uses the word I in this book or in this chapter. And you can even see it in the English. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. And it's all about I, me, mine, myself. And even the Beatles bemoan that. I, me, mine. And that's where Solomon is at in his thinking at this point. And what does this yield to him? I hated life. I hated all the fruit of my labor. Why? Because it was all about him. Nothing he did was for anybody else. It was all about himself. And as he says here, some might say, well, he built these great parks and the zoos and people could enjoy him. He didn't build them for that reason. He built them for himself. And guess what he found out? Living life that way doesn't make you happy. And so what do we expect out of that? Why are you miserable and unhappy? Because it's all about you. And until that changes, You're not going to find happiness in life pursuing your own agenda. It just doesn't work that way. You have to orient and acclimate to God's will, and that's what's going to be coming up in chapter 3. There's these times and seasons in God's plan, but they're all determined by God, not by us. Now, all we can do is orient to them. Or we can, fight against it, dig our heels in. I'm going to do it my way. And you're not going to be happy with that. You're going to find out it doesn't work. So as we've actually done verses 17 and 18, so I hated life. Existential despair, I've titled this section. For the work which was done under the sun was grievous to me, burdensome, evil, literally in the Hebrew, because everything is futility, and that's our word for vanity, hevel, and striving after the wind. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun. For I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows, verse 19 now, and who knows? And again, he's writing in general terms here, but also bear in mind that Solomon has a son, and he's got some specifics in his head about this. He knows that his son Rehoboam is not that much to speak of. And who knows whether, but he's writing in general terms, I must leave it to a man, even though he could have said, I'm going to leave it to Rehoboam. But this is to generalize it because it's true of all of us. When we die, everything we've worked hard for, all that we've accumulated in our life, is going to go to somebody else. And who knows whether that person's an idiot or a wise man. And every parent probably has this fear of they go through life. Maybe not every day, you wouldn't think about it. But you go through life, you work hard, you make all these sacrifices, and you leave it all to your children. Your children turn out to be idiots. That is depressing. I mean, that just makes me want to shoot myself to think about that. And this is what Solomon is bemoaning. Who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? He's got a pretty good idea already. Solomon does now. But again, he's generalizing here for this reason. And as a conjunction wow here plus the interrogative pronoun me. Me is who? Who knows? Cal active participle, literally. Who is knowing? He uses YADHA apostrophe. Who knows? And again, this the idea of the participle here is ongoing actions. So who can ever really figure this out? They might be a wise person at one point, then they might turn into a moron. Yeah, you've seen people do that. You've seen people make wise decisions, apply doctrine and all that, then peel off and become idiots. I've seen it all too many times. Future's gotten, again, the jury's out on all of us until the rapture and the bema seat. Who knows what's going to happen? The best you can do is hope, dear God, my prayer, don't let me become a fool. I've come this far. I've run this marathon for X amount of years, and I don't want to tube it at the end. And so, again, Christian life's a marathon. Who knows what person they're going to be 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road? Nobody knows. And if anybody tells you they know, they're lying to you. They don't know either. The answer here is, who knows? Nobody knows. Who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Actually, you got a definite article here, Kakam, the wise man. C-H-A-K-H-A-M. Who knows whether the wise man he will become, literally. They translated it be, but again, there's no to be verb in Hebrew. Hayah means to become. Who knows whether it will turn out, then the idea here, as I would translate it, who knows whether he'll turn out to be a wise man, the wise man, or a fool? And I think and one of the things that stood out to me here was he uses the definite article with the wise man, and he generalizes the fool. And I think that's because there are far fewer wise men than fools. The fool is a much broader class of people. The idiot, the moron. I love these terms. But guess what? These are biblical terms to describe, and they try to tone it down in the Bible, of course, because they don't want to offend people with, this kind of talk. So who knows whether he will become the wise man or a fool? Conjunction O. Looks like that, actually. Or, and then the masculine singular noun of Sakhal. S-A-K-H-A-L. Or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor. You got a lot of details you like, you've accumulated. Nice set of golf clubs, nice TV, everything, nice house, nice car. I got a Lexus. And guess who's going to get it? Somebody else. Somebody else is going to get it. And he will have control. And why does this bother Solomon? Because it bugs him to no end that he has no control over this. You can't control everything. It's just impossible. And you can't control what's going to happen, certainly after you die. So who knows whether he will be the wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. And that's even more galling. Not only, you know, if I'd have been an idiot and this all just fell to me, okay, that's one thing. I could at least say, well, somebody else is getting it, but I didn't deserve it either. But then you look at it and you say, no, I worked hard for this. I sacrificed. I saved. I scrimped. I did everything right. And guess what? Somebody else is going to control it. So he will have control as the Cal imperfect here of Shalat. S-H-A-L-A-T. This means to exercise power or authority over something. And this is the idea, is it's an authority word. And so obviously if he exercises power, has authority over it, it's his. He can do with it what he chooses. He will have authority over, prefix bait here plus coal, all. Over all, again, they've recognized here, you got the masculine singular noun of amal, and they've rightly supplied the fruit of my labor because he's looking at the output of what he's done. He's looking at the physical, tangible things he's going to leave behind. And so rightly here they have wisely supplied the fruit of my labor. Because he's looking not just at the work he did, but the results of that work. So he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, which, prefix, particle, sheen, plus again, male, the verb, again, which I worked hard, I labored, I rigorously did all this. And again, I don't think Solomon went out and did it all with his hands, but he had to plan it, he had to draw it up, he had to execute it, he had to oversee the whole thing. And he said it was hard work, it was labor, it was grueling at some point. And at the end of all of his grueling work, he had his beautifully manicured parks that you would just walk into and go, wow. And it was shady and it was cool in the summer and it had these animals, you know, Peter Cottontails bouncing around. And you thought, oh, this is pretty. He probably didn't put any gators in them. That wouldn't have worked. So, which I worked hard by acting wisely, and which, literally, they say by acting, but actually what you have here is a wow plus the prefix sheen, and which I acted wisely is the verb, kakam. I acted wisely under the sun. Indeed, conjunction gam, they just translate, they don't even translate it. Well, they translate it by the word to in the New American Standard. It's also indeed, even, indeed, this vanity. There, again, there's no to be verb, so you supply that in these nominal sentences. The near demonstrative adjective ze, and then our word, his favorite word, evil, vanity. This is emptiness. And really, again, the point of all of this is, is Solomon's viewpoint about all this valid? Is this all true? Do you leave everything to somebody else? Oh, yes, it's painfully true. You're not going to get around it. And so there isn't really anything in here you can argue with Solomon about, other than his faulty conclusion, say, in what we saw there, his logic was flawed in this earlier verse. But is his logic flawed here? No, it's all too painfully true. The reality is, of course, you leave everything to somebody else. That's true. You're not going to get around that. And do you really know what they're going to be? Nope. Do you know what your heir is going to be? Nope. And will you be alive to control anything? Nope. So how does this make you feel? Bad? I'm depressed. Solomon was, anyway. But this is all just a part of life, though, isn't it? I mean, really, is there anything here that's so horrible, that's so god-awful, really? I mean, you can't take it with you. Don't we all know that? Didn't we see that in 1 Timothy? This is why we were born with nothing. It was an object lesson to us. Matter of fact, turn there. 1 Timothy, I believe it was chapter 6. And it's not well translated in the New American Standard, but why is the Bible with all this talk about the details and how we orient to them? Now God's gone to meddling. Couldn't he just leave well enough alone and save us? Guess what he's saving us from? Ourselves. 1 Timothy 6 here, verse 7. Again, it's since we have brought nothing into the world. The idea here is God let us be born with nothing. When you came into this world, how did you come? Did you have a car? Any details? Any money? No. Nope. You were born absolutely without anything. Not even clothes you didn't have. And how are you going to die? Same way. You're going out the same way. You're going to leave it all behind. Since we have brought nothing into the world, since we cannot take anything out of it either. And our birth is supposed to be an object lesson to us. Now, how many times have you heard this? Our birth is supposed to be an object lesson to us. We can't take it with us. And we all know it's true. But yet some people live as though they can, I guess. I don't know. Why bother? Okay, well, back to our verses here. Point one, as the preceding verses have indicated, Koheleth had pretty much done it all, seen it all, considered it all, and come to one unavoidable, irrefutable conclusion. All men die. Two, when one considers all the activities in which Solomon engaged, there is a very real sense in this chapter that no part of his accomplishments ultimately fulfilled him. So think to yourself today, okay, however old you are, what do I want to be in life? What do I want to do? What do I want to accomplish? If I did X, fill in the blank with whatever trips your trigger, will I be happy? This would make me happy. And I guarantee you, you're wrong. Put in anything in there you want. It won't make you happy unless it's God's will. There's the X factor. Unless it's God's will. What will make you happy is doing God's will. And if you're not happy doing God's will, you're not going to be happy anyway. So that's just the way life is. So all men die, and again, then you can go out and do anything you want in the interim, in the meantime. Okay, what are we waiting for? It's God's big waiting room. Next. That's what we usually made that joke when we first moved down here. You go out to the beach and you watch all these old people walking back and forth. It's God's big waiting room. And what are they waiting for? To die? Well, at least I got a nice view. While you're waiting to die, you might as well live on the Gulf, I guess. So you move to Sarasota and you have all you want. Nice condo, out on a long boat, exclusive community. Will you be happy? No, you're just waiting to die. And so, and then when you do die, what's going to happen to all your stuff? Somebody else is going to get it. So again, this didn't really fulfill him. He's done it all. What a lesson to people. I've done it all, people. Listen to me. But he doesn't come across in that preachy sort of way. He holds himself up and says, look how bad I was. Look at what an idiot I was. And I'm telling you, this idiotic young Solomon wasn't happy. And so what makes people happy? Again, we get into some intangibles here. What is happiness? What is joy? What is pleasure? And what is fulfillment? What is contentment? We're exhorted, be content with such things as you have. What is contentment? Well, these are intangibles. These are things in life that only God can provide ultimately. If the human experience could provide all this, it'd be great, I suppose. But the fact is, the reality is, we know it can't. Solomon knows it can't. So three, when the lack of fulfillment is coupled with the realization that it makes no difference whether one is wise or foolish, since all men die equally, it leads to a palpable sense of frustration. He's frustrated. He's depressed. This doesn't sound like a happy camper again to me. So four, although the sense of frustration has been below the surface in the previous verses, it comes boiling out in verse 17 with a vengeance. I hated it. Solomon isn't writing along nicely. Blah, 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 and I hated it. Oh, he's miserable. When you really hate something, you have a way of expressing it, don't you? So again, this comes boiling out now. Oh, it comes to the surface with a vengeance. Oh, I hate this. Five, the extremely strong emotion of hatred is somewhat of a strange attitude for one that was recognized to be very wise, since he would have known the benefit of wisdom was long life. Again, our verses here, Proverbs 3:2. We see, and Solomon wrote these, so we know he knew these verses. He's clear on this. My son, do not forget my teaching. This is parental teaching of doctrine, which is the way it should be. The parents are the primary teachers of doctrine to the children. Obviously, the prep school and church can supplement. But they have to have an example and the doctrine articulated on a day-to-day basis. Here's the truth. Let your heart keep my commandments, for length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Does Solomon sound like he's at peace now? Why? Because he hasn't done this himself. And he's writing more from, I think, a do as I say and not as I did. And isn't that how most of us parents teach our children? You see, all of us parents, we've lived through life. Anybody that's a parent, and we know where a lot of the landmines are. We don't know where they all are, but we know where a lot of them are. We've learned, and very often, where have we learned the most? At OU? No, we learn most of it in the school of hard knocks, don't we? We learn most of it by mistakes and landmines we stepped on. Oh, I blew my leg off there. That hurt. Don't step there. You really don't want to step there. And so we've learned the hard way. And so we teach our children, look, I've been there. I've seen it. I know way more than you know. And that, of course, our children just are endeared to us for telling them that. They get up every morning and say, thank you, God, my parents are smarter than me. Or not. But we've all, you know, remember when you were a child, I always try to factor all of this in with, you know, what was I doing? You know, when these kids pull up at the thing with their box booming and you can't stand it and you just want to... And I think, well, wait a second, what was I doing when I was 18? Same thing. That I'm so intolerant of now, but I was that way too. And so, and you got to that point in your life where you realized, oh, my parents are idiots. I'm way smarter than they are. And then you come to another point in your life where you realize, oh, maybe they weren't. Maybe they were smarter than I thought. Maybe they knew something I didn't know. Well, that's what David tells his son here, Solomon. When he's young, he's telling him, hey, son, listen, follow my teaching. I've given it to you straight. I've given it to you right. Verse 16, long life is in her hand, wisdom. And in her left hand are riches and honors. Honor. Her ways are pleasant ways. And all her paths are peace. She's a tree of life to those that take hold of her. And happy are all who hold her fast. Does Solomon sound happy? Why? He's abandoned wisdom at some point. Even though he's still a wise guy, he's abandoned wisdom at some point. Also 4:22. For they are life to those who find her, and health to all their body. I see some people that have chronic health problems. I'm not saying that, and I try not to judge, because you don't have all the facts and you don't know. But there's a sense in which wisdom is supposed to be a benefit health-wise even. So if I get a cold, you can say, well, he must be under discipline. No. No, and people will have health problems. And some things you can't avoid. But there is a sense in which wisdom is supposed to help with your health even. And that's a fundamental thing that you can't really control. I mean, we can't control whether we're healthy or not. But God can. God can. And I've seen people, I've seen some that have these chronic problems. And I look back now and I see some of these chronic problems may have been caused by mental attitude sins and bitterness and unforgiveness and all that. You store that up. As one guy told me, he said, well, I know it's not healthy, but I suppress all my emotions until they're a tight little ball in my stomach. And then I wonder why I need Maalox. It's probably not good to suppress your emotions. We know that. So the idea here is, though, there is a certain benefit. There's a health benefit in wisdom. And I'm not going to run around and judge, oh, they were sick or they had this or that, so they must be out of God's will. It's not for me to judge. It's not for you to judge. But we can say what the Scripture clearly says here. Their health to your body. Also 8:35. For he who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. And again, this is wisdom. So that if you really want life, you've got to pursue wisdom. But again, life is one of these intangibles. How do you define life? What is your life? It's all these things, all you touch and all you see. You know, this is life. And there are things that come to you you can't control. There are things you can control. There's the charge of the elephant, the charge of the mosquito, all that. So again, here, you would think this is a strange emotion of hatred. But again, Solomon is self-centered, self-absorbed, self-consumed. And what does he get out of it? He hates it all. Well, guess what? The self-centered person is never truly happy. The idea that you can live life without thinking about anybody but yourself will never, ever make you happy. It will just lead to the same misery that Solomon now vocalizes. Six, while his statement about hating life was quite personal, he does not limit it to his own existence by saying that I hated my life. I think he hates life in general at this point. And if, God forbid that you should have been happy in his presence. Come and tell him a joke. Hey, Solomon, how you doing? Take my wife, please. You know, Solomon wouldn't have laughed. He probably would have had you killed. And you know, misery loves company. Some miserable people tend to gravitate towards each other. God, I can't say. Can you imagine being in that circle of friends? Pass. Instead, point seven, it is a general statement about hating all life as he has observed it. It has the force of telling the reader that everyone's life is worth hating. I don't just hate mine, I hate yours too. I'm an equal opportunity hater. And your life isn't any better than mine. And of course, nobody's life was better than Solomon's at a fundamental physical level. So he hated it all. What a miserable person. But I have to admire him again here, the humility of writing this about yourself, of saying, this is who I was. And I don't think he's proud of it, probably looking back. I don't think he's saying, oh, I encourage you all to do this. Again, point eight, one must recognize that Solomon is not saying that he has this sense of emotional despair at the time of writing. He is accurately recording the unpleasant conclusion to which he had come earlier in his life. He's telling you about this period of his life. Again, there was the Solomon that was unhappy sort of in the beginning. There was this Solomon that went through this experiment on himself. There's the Solomon that comes out on the other end drawing conclusions. And then there's the older, wiser Solomon writing the book. There's at least that many voices in this book. And probably more. But they're all Solomon. It's all him talking. So nine, another fact that should be observed in this section is the number of times that Koheleth uses the first person verb and or the first person pronoun I. 10 of the 88 times he uses the first person in this book, which decreases dramatically towards the end of the book. Almost half, 42 of them are found within the first two chapters. It's all about him. And when it's all about you, what does it become? Misery, gloom, despair, depression. Well, if it's all about you, then selfish people are not happy people. I don't get the impression when I read the Gospels and I check out the historical narrative about the life of Christ, I don't get the impression that Jesus was this unhappy, depressed sort of character just waiting to die. I get the impression that he lived life fully in that moment. I get the impression that he had capacity for it. I get the impression that he understood things that were going on around him, and it wasn't all about him. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. And he demonstrated his humility, and you see that in John chapter 13 there, where he washes the disciples' feet. Now, he's given them an object lesson in rebound that they don't understand, but he's also physically, literally washing their feet. And why is he doing all that? Well, to demonstrate his true humility is one reason. And I think he had capacity for it. He didn't get down and say, oh God, I got to wash these people's feet. I hate this. I think he did it. He recognized it's the right thing to do. It's God's timing. It's what I'm supposed to do. And he did it. And he said, I have food to eat that you don't know about. That's what he told the disciples when they said, we got to be hungry. We got to go eat. Jesus said, I have food you don't know about. He said, doing the will of God's my food. This is what supports me. This is what sustains me. And I don't get the impression, again, just even on the surface of reading it, that he was this, you know, I'm doing the will of God, but I'm gritting my teeth about it. I'm Jesus. I hate you. You know, I hate life. I got the impression Jesus actually enjoyed life. Jesus didn't want to die, by the way. That comes pretty loud and clear in the Garden of Gethsemane. He wasn't looking forward to death in any way. That doesn't sound like a depressed person that wants to die or is miserable to me. So, again, he said, you know, my food's doing the will of God. This is what sustains me. And this is where life is to be found, is in doing the will of God. This is what life is. But for Solomon at this point, especially in his life, in this book, it's all about him. Again, half the times almost, the first person is used here. So 11, Koheleth is so consumed with his own questions, logic, conclusions, concerns, etc., that he makes no dimension of God. Another thing you'd notice in this chapter, where's God in all this? He's never mentioned. It's almost as though he doesn't exist. He's living his life like he's a functional atheist. And guess what? Apparently that doesn't make you happy either. So he makes no mention of God other than the derogatory, "I have seen the grievous task which God has given the sons of men to be afflicted with, the heavy, burdensome task called life that God has afflicted people with, until the light begins to break in." And we sort of see the light, and again, he's not going to get there quick. But when you get to this point, you don't necessarily get out of it quick. When you get to this point of depression and bottoming out, you don't necessarily recover from that overnight. And nor should you, I don't think. So Ecclesiastes 2:24. So what's his conclusion then? Given all these things, and we're still working towards this conclusion. "There is nothing better for a man to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. And this I have seen, that it's from the hand of God." The person that actually enjoys life, that can live on a day-to-day basis, enjoy their food, function under grace, understand God's blessing, and live life and enjoy it. Does it get any better than that? Answer is, no, it doesn't. So maybe sometimes, you know, and I ask myself the same thing, though, you know, do I set my standards too high? Am I expecting too much sometimes? And we want to set our standards high. We don't want to just live at the lowest possible level of human existence, I don't think. But what is life, and what is it ever going to be? Is it ever going to be this great thing people think it is? And that they're out there pursuing so they can get there. And what they're going to find out is once they get there, they still aren't there yet. Life is lived on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis. And until he starts to factor God into it, and again, he does this in sort of a oblique, well, here he's not oblique. He says this is from the hand of God. He finally mentions God as actually giving blessing to the human race. And here you have the opposite of what he said at the end of chapter 1. It's his grievous burden. Now he says, no, here's God blessing people. This is from the hand of God. This has to do with God's sovereignty and his omnipotence, his power. And who can eat, verse 25, and who can have enjoyment without him? Question? Answer? Nobody. So he kind of realizes, he starts to break through this, and he kind of realizes, okay, you know, this kind of, you got to factor God into this now. I did all this, and I really wasn't factoring God in. Now I'm going to factor God into it. And even then, he doesn't immediately, he kind of turns the corner, but he doesn't immediately just say, oh yes, oh God. There it is. God's. Here's how it works. Because chapter 3, again, when you get into this poem at the beginning of chapter 3 is not designed to be, he's bemoaning the fact that God's in charge of these times. Not that they come as much as the fact that we can't control them. There's a time to mourn and a time to dance. How do you know when that time is going to come upon you? And the idea there, mourning has to do, I think, with mourning and if I remember right, I don't remember, I don't have my notes, but I think it's mourning in terms of grieving for a dead person. So there's a time to keep and a time to throw away. How do you know which time, when is it going to come upon you? I remember when I was a kid, you know, for us, it was always in the spring. You had your spring cleaning. That was the time to throw away. You'd clean out the garage, all that stuff that you hadn't touched in a year. And then some people still won't throw it away. If you haven't used it in a year, you probably don't need it. I mean, there might be some weird thing that you might only use once every 5 years, I guess. But how do we know when the time to keep is? How do we know when the time to lose something? How do we know when to quit searching for it? But these things come upon you. And that's God's department in that sense. So again, the light finally does start to break in. He recognizes, hey, well, God's in charge of this. 12, Koheleth is painfully and obviously self-absorbed during this section of his life. This is one sure path to misery and despair, confirming what Jesus Christ said about the nature of life, Luke 9:23 through 25. So why do we, again, why do we have to teach our children right out of the box to not be selfish, to share, and to be nice? Because we naturally, as human beings, know all those other things. We know how to be selfish and mean and all that. That we don't have to teach them. What we have to teach them is how to be the opposite. But why? Because ultimately we know as adults, as parents, we know that this is where satisfaction comes from in life. Hopefully we've figured that one out. Luke 9, 23 through 25 here. And he was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. For what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? Nothing. So you've got it all. And we have many parables to that effect. The parable of the rich fool. Hey, I've got everything. I've got barns. They're not big enough. I'm going to tear them down, build new, bigger barns to put all my stuff in. Because once I get all my stuff in those barns, then I'm going to kick back and take it easy. And I'm going to retire and live the high life. And God says to him, oh, you fool, you die tonight. You die tonight. So, again, nobody has death penciled in today in their day planner, I'll bet. We don't know. You just don't know. And that can either lead to, see, some people look at that and they say, well, I'm glad I don't know. I wouldn't want to know. Or you can look at it like Solomon, you just don't know and God controls it, bummer. Well, do you really want to know? So 13, like any believer that goes through a time of concern, doubt, misery, or even despair. I do know how to spell or, and that isn't it. Koheleth will not come back from the edge of insanity quickly. You're insane at a certain point when you're doing this kind of stuff. You've lost your focus completely. And so he holds himself up. Look, I'm a guy who lost my focus. I did it all my way, and I'm not happy about it. Now, do you want to try this? The wise person looks at it and says, oh, no thanks. I mean, have you been reading chapter 2 going, oh, goody, this is great? No, it's depressing. It's supposed to be depressing. So why does Solomon want to depress us? You might ask, why has God got this in here? Why? Because when you get to this point, you start to ask yourself, isn't there something better? And if there is something better, what is it? And how do I get it? How do I be one of these people, as he says there at the end of chapter 2, he says, verse 26, for to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy. Okay. And to the sinner, he is given the task of gathering and collecting, so he may give it to the one who is good in God's sight. Well, which one do you want to be? And how do you become the person that's good in God's sight? I mean, this begs these questions, I think. So again, he will not come back from the edge of insanity quickly. He will gradually make advances throughout this book, just like the Christian life for all of us, isn't it? Again, wouldn't it be great? I get up and teach the doctrine once. You get it and apply it perfectly from then on. And it's a straight line growth just to glory. But that's not the Christian life for us, is it? We're like that. We're all over the place from time to time. And you have your up days, you have your down days, you have your up weeks, you have your down weeks, you have your good months, good years, bad years even. And so, again, as long as you're alive, there's hope. You can change it. He makes these gradual advances. But this is true to life, though, isn't it? And that's another thing we say about the Bible. God doesn't attempt to hide even the greatest character's flaws. We see Abraham putting his wife in a harem, not once, but twice. We see him listening to Sarah and having sex with Hagar, and then they get into all kinds of trouble because of that. Then we see him listening to Sarah and throwing the Hagar out, and God blesses him. So how do you know what to do? And we see Solomon, we see David and his big aberration. You think people are shocked now? God, the pastor commits murder and adultery? Well, David was still the king, near as I can tell. God wasn't finished with him. Oh, he failed, and he failed big time. So we see these. We see it in Solomon's life here. He failed, and he failed big time. And in a sense, what he's saying, without being preachy, is don't do this. Do you really want to go live life this way? I don't. So 14, he introduces his explanation of why he was disgusted with life, as he indicates that all the work he saw being done was nothing more than a burden to him. 15, while everyone might not come to the same conclusion, it is fair to say at this point, Koheleth is saying that all this life just seems wrong to him. Have you ever been to that point in your life where everything just seems wrong to you? It just isn't working. It's depressing. It's not working. And you may not have stayed at that point long, but it probably occurred to you. And guess what? That just makes you a normal person. Sometimes it all just seems wrong. But it certainly seems wrong to him at this point. 16, as he expresses his repugnance for all that he sees in this world, one might expect that his logical conclusion would simply be to end it all. Now, that's another whole point. Have you been very depressed and wanted to end it all, but you didn't? Why? Well, because one thing we've got going for us is the same thing he got going for him. He still has some doctrine in his soul. While he may have abandoned and walked away from it and done some really foolish stuff, it isn't as though he lost all his doctrine. He still considers life to be sacred, that God's in charge of life, not him. And so, have you ever wanted to end it all? Yeah, but doesn't your greater sense say, that's stupid thinking. It's stupid to think that way. Even if life is difficult, even as bad as it is, do I really want to die? And sometimes you might think you do. There's a couple of times I've thought it. But you don't do it. And he doesn't do it. He never advocates in here, just end it all. Although, after reading this, I'm about ready to end it all. Again, it's depressing. I think it's designed to be. So 17, however, Koheleth, even at his worst moment, recognizes that God is the author of life and that only he has the right to take life. That was set forth for us after the flood in Genesis 9, 5, and 6. It's never been rescinded. This was the introduction of the principle of capital punishment to the world, which God has never rescinded either, much to the liberal chagrin. Genesis 9, 5. Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man. From every man's brother I will require the life of man. For whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood will be shed. For in the image of God he made man, i.e. God made man. And the idea here is, since God created life, only God's got the right to take life. And we see this acknowledgement in Ecclesiastes there in chapter 2, that this is from the hand of God. And even grudgingly, he will admit, even the bad times in life, God controls them. We don't control them, God controls them. Ecclesiastes 2, 24 and 25, well, we've read that. Who can eat and drink and have enjoyment without him? The life comes from God. And so since it comes from God, then God should be the only one to have the right to end it, other than capital punishment, when a person goes out and murders another person, they should be killed. And that's just God's plan. So, 18, even with his frustration and distaste for life as he has seen it, Koheleth recognizes that man is responsible to God, who will judge all men according to his standards. 3:17, he acknowledges that. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. For a time, for every matter, and for every deed is there. And God ultimately is the judge of all this. And that men are ultimately responsible to God. Now, whether they want to admit it or acknowledge it doesn't make it any less true. They are. So 19, in fact, it is only real faith in God that will enable the believer to withstand such crises of faith, which every believer will suffer at some point in his Christian life. You're going to come to periods of severe testing. You're going to come through periods of real evil, and certain things happen. You have no control over it. You're gonna watch people crash and burn, and you can't do a thing about it. And you're gonna have these times of crisis that'll happen in life. It happens to everybody. Nobody's above it. Here was Abraham's test. And he passed this test. We'll cite, obviously there are times when people come to these huge things and they pass them, they get through them, they apply doctrine towards them. And there are other times where they don't. They just fall apart and you see what they're made of, and they're not made of much. Their Christian life appeared to be a house of cards and it's just crumbled. Reminds me of that Mark Knopfler song. When the rock you stood upon is broken up and gone, who's your baby now? You're going to have to think about it. Because you're going to have a crisis. It's going to happen. I guarantee you, because this was taught under that same idea of the parable, building the house on the rock and building it on the sand. And the storms came. The storms come to both houses. But which house is going to stand? Which house will survive the test of all this? Only the house built on doctrine will. Genesis here, 22:1 and following, it came about after these things that God tested Abraham. And other than the test here, you could just plug your name. It came about after these things that God tested Ron. Well, there are things that are going to happen to you. God's going to test you. And he said to Abraham, here am I. He said Abraham, and Abraham said, here am I. Take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac. Go to Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains. What? Go out and Ola Karban him, huh? Okay. It's God's will. God told me. And Abraham took this test, didn't say a word to Sarah, kept it to himself, went out and passed this test. And how did he pass it? Well, we're told later in Hebrews, actually. He passed it because he believed the doctrine of resurrection. Doctrine got him through this test. Because Abraham's reasoning was this. Isaac is the only heir. He's the promised heir. I know this is supernatural. God has done it. And so if God tells me to kill him, the only logical conclusion is, then God's got to raise him from the dead. And he thought through it, and he applied the doctrine to it, and he got through this test. And he showed he was willing to kill. It never was God's will for him to kill Isaac, of course. But he tested him with this. Now, that was a big test. God told me to kill you, son. Genesis 39, we see here, for instance, this I think is about Joseph, where his family turns on him. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is Joseph in Egypt. But you're going to have that test. Your relatives turn on you. That'll happen in life, trust me. You hope it never will come to you, but it will, probably. It happens to a lot of people. So that's a part of the test. Jesus' family, they thought he was nuts. They wanted to have him committed. Run around telling people you're God. Stop it. And so Genesis 39, here you had Joseph's family. Why is he in Egypt in the first place? His brothers decided to sell him as a slave. Well, that wasn't very nice. But Joseph got through all this. God blessed him. Again, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, bought him and puts him in his house. And so Joseph gets there, and he gets a good job, and he's doing well, and God's blessing him, and then he gets the test of the horsey woman. Oh, you're going to get those in life, too. The test of the horsey woman. And this woman was a liar, did all kinds of weird stuff. But, then he's thrown in prison for something he didn't do. I'd say that's a pretty big test. So, again, when you come to these crises, these big tests in life, how are you going to get through them? I don't think there's any way other than doctrine, seriously. Look at the entire book of Job. God allows Satan to go out and work on him. Do whatever he wants to, essentially. Gives him carte blanche with Job, other than he can't kill him. So he kills all his family, trashes all his details, takes his health. So again, this idea, only God controls the weather. I got a verse that says Satan can control it. He sends this big storm, a tornado or hurricane, whatever it was. And obviously he can only control it within the permissive will of God. We understand that. But he does all these things. Kills his kids, incites these people to war against Job, takes all his details, and then strikes his health, takes his health away from him. And so when he comes to all this, can Job withstand the crisis? Well, he does for a long time. You got to admire Job. He does for a long time. But then even Job cracks under it. And when you read this book, you've got to read this knowing that when Job gets, like, say, chapter 3 there, and when he opens his mouth and cursed the day of his birth, this is a believer out of fellowship. He's not. So after that, I'm taking everything with a grain of salt. Because this is Job under his STA, under his sin nature. And his friends, of course, they're mentally judging Job, so they're out of fellowship. Job's a secret sinner. God did all this because Job's been hiding something. No, Job wasn't hiding anything. This was just a test that God allowed in his life, a huge one. And God, at the end of it all, of course, Job grew spiritually through this. God blessed him with all that he had and more at the end of it all. Okay, well, our time is really up, so we're going to have to look at these other verses on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.